Let's call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee meeting to order. Let the record reflect, it's about 3 minutes after 2 o'clock on Tuesday, January 26, 2010. Let the record reflect that there is a quorum, and present here today, seated to my immediate left, is Senator Davis. To her left is Senator Bundy. On my right is Senator Thomas, and two to the right is Senator Meyer, and of course myself, Senator Paskvan. Thank you for joining us today. We are in a new venue. This is the Belts Room in the Thomas Stewart Legislative Building. It is our intent to have Senate Labor and Commerce meet in this room and in this building during this legislative session, so if you need to find us, here we are. It is good to return to this table with my colleagues, and I look forward to working with each of you to advance a legislation that does benefit the people of Alaska. It is my goal as the chair of Senate Labor and Commerce to provide a committee process that will fairly represent all concerns with the issues that we must address while keeping the deliberations efficient. And as always, I am open to your comment, feedback, suggestions on the labor and commerce bills that will do exactly that, advance the issues of Alaskans. I want to, at this time, to welcome back my committee staff, Jeff Stepp over here. We have other committee staff, Jane, Christine, Tom, and I would like to also, at this time, the Senator Thomas' staff is new this year, Murray Richmond, so off to the left there. So the labor and commerce issues, introducing Murray Richmond. And I was also glad to learn that Ann is again with us. And also, as I understand, this is Tim from the Juneau LIO. So I think we have a great support staff all around us. As you know, logistically, so that anyone that may be interested in labor and commerce issues understand the logistics, that we have three members of this committee also are seated on the Senate Transportation Committee, which meets immediately before this. And Senator Kukesh and I have reached an agreement, essentially, where he's going to be meeting from 1 until approximately 2 o'clock, and then this committee will start 2:15, 2 like we did today, sometimes 2:30, depending upon labor and commerce. But we hope we can work through any of these issues. And so anyway, I appreciate your flexibility and understanding that we're working through those issues. Anyway, the purpose of today's meeting is to address Senate Bill 97, which is a crane licensure bill. This bill was advanced by the Department of Labor and Workforce Development under the leadership of Commissioner Bishop. And under Senate Bill 97, the legislation that was introduced last session was introduced as a Senate Labor and Commerce Committee bill. And this committee first heard this Senate Bill 97 on March 19th of last year, and I will trust that everyone is up to date. And I know I recall the testimony from individuals, and if necessary, you can obtain the minutes for that meeting on March 19th, 2009. I would like to begin by welcoming Gray Mitchell. Gray Mitchell is from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to review this legislation, discuss developments that have occurred since last March, and certainly you can come to the head table. We are hoping that you can review the legislation with us, discuss the developments since we last met, and to tell us a little bit about the incident. It was somewhat alarming with the incident while they were building the sky bridge between the Stewart building and the main legislative offices. And while it's not directly covered by the parameters of this crane bill, I think it is an incident that points out to the issue of workplace safety, job safety, and so that's, I think, ultimately what we are trying to advance in this crane bill. So public testimony will follow Mr. Mitchell's presentation. It is my intent to hold this bill in committee today, so it is not my intent that we pass this bill out of this committee today. It is also my intent that we will conclude today's meeting at 3 o'clock. But given that parameters, Mr. Mitchell, the floor is yours, and as you may likely know, as identify yourself and your affiliation for the record.
Thank you, and good afternoon to the committee. My name is Gray Mitchell. I am the director of the Labor Standards and Safety Division and Department of Labor and Workforce Development. I'd like to start with a request, if I could. I have a resident expert in cranes, and his name is Jerry Andrews, and he's sitting right here. And if I could have him join me in case...
Not a problem. I don't see any reason why the expert shouldn't be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator, and I appreciate I've never been to that point anyway. So my name is Jerry Andrews. I'm the pipeline training administrator for the Department of Labor, but in a past position, I was a training coordinator for the operating engineers Local 302, and currently carry an NCCO certification for all levels of the NCCO card. So thank you for
all right.
your time.
Thank you, Gray Mitchell, again. I have just a few statements to update the committee on what's happened since the last hearing. Crane accident reports continue to flow in across the country. Fatalities and serious injuries are a common occurrence. On average, we're seeing 60 to 80 fatalities per year that involve crane operation throughout the country. In Alaska, we have avoided a fatal crane incident over the last year, but it can happen in Alaska, and your bill packets have the history that represents that. You know, in 10 years prior to 1997, there were 15 crane accidents and 10 serious injuries, and 9 Alaskans lost their lives in those accidents. And we have some good examples just down the street with the huge crane that's operating on the parking garage facility. Just imagine what would happen if the operator had made a miscalculation and dropped a load as it was swinging over Main Street, or perhaps miscalculated the wind or the necessary base for the crane, and it suffered a malfunction and tipped over. These kinds of accidents are deadly. But in general, accidents with smaller equipment are more frequent and can be just as deadly. Most of you have heard of the accident that was referred to by Senator Pascavan at the Capitol building here that made an easy walk from the building next door possible. Two workers suffered severe injuries, and that accident involved a small powered industrial truck that was being used with a work platform to elevate these two workers who were putting windows in the sky bridge. This case the citations have been issued, but it is still open for contest. And so you'll hear me use the word alleged, and that is just to provide respect for the fact that there is still a potential for contest, and there is just allegations at this point. But the state has alleged that the operator in that incident did not have sufficient training and experience. He was not properly certified to operate that piece of equipment. And that is a prime example of what can happen when someone gets behind the controls that is not properly trained to operate the equipment. When you consider what's at stake, it's clear that we need trained and qualified people behind the controls. Federal OSHA is in the process of revising their crane standards. This is a large package of regulations that applies across the industry. It's not just on crane operator certification. It covers A to Z from, the actual crane parts to themselves, inspections of cranes, qualifications of inspectors, manufacturing, and so on. It's 240 pages long, so it's quite extensive. The process has been ongoing since 2002. A hearing was just held early in January, and there's another hearing that's scheduled March 20th of 2010. Significant public comment could cause additional delays. According to the federal OSHA website, they are planning on having this rule final by July of 2010. If everything goes perfectly and that happens, there still will be a four-year window from that date for crane operators to become certified. Alaska can't wait for the federal government to solve this problem, and that's where Senate Bill 97 comes in to play. And this bill goes beyond OSHA regulations. As you know, OSHA regulations only apply to employees, protection of employees. Senate Bill 97 is designed to protect general public safety and covers anyone who gets behind the controls of a crane. Since last year's hearing on this bill, two more states have established requirement for crane operator certification, in Maryland and North Carolina. And studies have shown that this certification does make a difference, and there are studies in your bill packet to help illustrate that. Training for crane operation is becoming more accessible. Just 2 weeks ago, the Crane Institute of America provided a four-day training course in Anchorage, and the business in Kenai, Alaska Crane Consultants, provides routine training throughout the state on crane operation. So to sum up, we do have licensing laws for various occupations in Alaska. As an example, a person has to have 1,650 hours of accredited training at a cost of $6,000 in Alaska, pass a test, pay $205 in fees, and obtain a license in order to cut your hair. We should not wait for a long string of accidents to establish crane operator licensing in Alaska. Thanks for hearing my testimony, and I am available for questions.
Senator Bundy. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hi, Gray.
Hi.
Could you just walk us through, a young guy wants to become a crane operator. I assume he has to be a member of operating engineers, but how, you mentioned the training program, how often are they available? How would he access it, and what are the costs?
Well, let me provide what I know, and Jerry will provide the rest through the chair, Senator Bundy. In order to sit for the crane exam, there are minimum experience requirements that must be met, and that includes 1,000 hours of crane operator time. There really isn't a training requirement per se, but you have to pass a test, and that's what this training program is about, this prep training. It's an intensive four-day course to help operators prepare to pass the test. Do you have anything to add?
And thank you, Senator Bundy. To become a crane operator would be not unlike becoming a truck driver, if you would, passing the CDL. An individual would not have to be a member of any local union, although the local unions offer that training through their apprenticeship programs. And crane operator apprenticeship is an apprenticeable occupation. It's 8,000 hours. It would cover all areas of the occupation that the NCCO would test on and make sure that that individual is competent for it. However, there is no deal breaker that individual go through an apprenticeship program, although I would think that Commissioner Bishop would fully support an apprenticeship program for this occupation. Today, an individual, as long as they're healthy and they can pass a medical examination and pass the written and practical test, they can take that test in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kenai, down here in Juneau. I don't know if there is a training that's been provided down here, although I know that the bookwork has been trained, provided by the operating engineers down here for their members. For other employers, such as North Slope employers, I know that many of them have taken this training to the North Slope, and that Crane Institute of America that Gray referred to does training throughout the state, so the training is available for them also.
Just to follow up, thank you. You mentioned they had to have 1,000 hours, but we passed this bill, they can't get those hours unless they're certified. I mean, it's catch-22 here.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, there is a provision in the bill that allows for a trainee to become licensed without, you know, the full journeyman certification. Of course, it requires direct and continuous supervision by a licensed crane operator, but that is the method to learn or to get that 1,000 hours of seat time.
All right.
And if I might just sort of clarify my understanding, and you know, I'm not opposed to the safety factor here. I'm just thinking about the practical impact of it. So if a person has a contract, needs a crane operator, basically to apprentice someone, they'd have to hire two, the certified operator and then the person who's being trained. So becoming an operator will not be easy nor inexpensive, probably. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I suppose that might be the case in some circumstances, although it's sort of hard to imagine that, you know, some business is just going to automatically need a crane and an operator out of the blue. I mean, they're going to be in that business. You know, most of the businesses that use cranes use them on a regular basis, and you know, they're going to have operators in place. And you know, we do have a significant number of operators in Alaska already, so I believe that there will be a training resource available for Alaskans, because we do have experienced crane operators in the state.
Thank you.
Mr. Mitchell, I noted in looking at the fiscal notes that last year's estimate was for 1,000 licenses per year. This year's fiscal note predicts 700. You know, why? What's changed? Kind of.
I don't have a quick response for that. I know that we went through more evaluation this year than we did last year on developing the final numbers that we put in the fiscal note, and so you'll see there's a change to the expenditures that we estimated as well as the revenue that we projected from the 700 licenses that we projected there.
I mean, are there 300 less crane operators, or was it just an estimate that was high last year and more accurate now, or just in other words, I don't know whether it's significant or not significant is my question.
Senator Pascavan, we believe it's accurate, that the current fiscal note is accurate.
Okay. Do you believe that the department would have any problem quickly implementing the licensure requirements? In other words, if this were to pass, you know, what if you could address that topic of your implementation of that?
Senator Pascavan, I do not believe that the department would have a serious problem implementing the requirements. There would be some need for a period of time to develop regulations, and these regulations would be fairly extensive because they would include all of the provisions concerning, you know, hearings, investigation procedures, appeal procedures, you know, so that part of it would probably require 6 months to a year in order to implement.
Okay. Any further questions from the committee? Hearing none, Mr. Mitchell, thank you. I know, Mr. Andrews, you're here, and you know, you look like you have something you want to say.
Well, I appreciate it, Senator Pascavan. In closing, and maybe to refer back to Senator Bundy's question on a training program, many of these cranes that we see that are operating in that classification of under 17 and a half tons and over 17 and a half tons, if I can kind of help with envisioning how an individual could become a qualified crane operator. The crane that we have sitting down here just to the outside of this building or on the next block over, that crane has a crane operator, and it probably has a crane oiler. Now, that crane oiler would be, if you would, an apprentice operator. That individual is the individual that's maintaining the crane, that is greasing it, oiling it, making sure that it's safe, and looking over the shoulder of the crane operator. That crane operator then, on occasion, when it's safe enough to allow that entry-level person or that oiler to operate, then that oiler becomes the operator. The crane operator now looks over the shoulder to make sure it's safe to operate. Just like, if I can make the analogy, if an individual was wanting to become a 747 pilot, we wouldn't just turn them loose because we do not have a certification process for them. Get your private's license, that's the under 17 and a half ton. And then from there, you would build upon your experience, not only in your hours, but also in the complexity of the crane. And those cranes that we see that are 300 and 400 ton out there, those individuals have gone through that process, if you would. So it's multifaceted, but it's based on safety, and it's based on qualification of the crane operators, and that's what makes it safe. So I hope that helps that vision, if you would. So
is it fair to say you do not see this licensing process as a barrier to work in the field?
No, I don't. My experience in the past 10-15 years of training and encouraging individuals to become certified crane operators, those individuals are doing it because the employers realize that the crane standards was written in 1971. It has not been updated since 1971. The ANSI regulations have been consistently updated every year or every other year as needed. So we've had the industry evolve and the operators that are safe in the industry evolving with it. What's lagged behind is the OSHA standard. So for us to bring this up to speed and use NCCO as the standard, I think we can quite honestly say that that or its equivalent be the standard of the industry should not be an encumbrance to the industry. The industry should be able to accept it quite easy because of the connection to the ANSI regulations and then now to the new proposed OSHA standard coming out. And in closing, this crane operator license is only one facet of that overarching standard to be presented here in July. So,
okay. Specifically addressing the 17 and a half ton capacity that this bill currently has, if you could comment upon that, and is that the ANSI, ANSI? Is that? In other words, you're talking in acronyms, so
right.
I don't know that any.
American National Standards Institute, or yeah. ASME, American Society of Mechanical Engineers. It's used universally here because about 7 years ago, American Society of Mechanical Engineers is now the regulatory body, body that holds the standard at this time. 17 and a half ton comes from the industry. Specialized Carriers and Riggers Association back in about 1994 realized that we had a huge amount of crane accidents that were going on and there was a loss of life and a loss of property. So their casualty group decided that if they were going to address craning in America, similar to what the Canadian government did in Ontario in the 70s, that they needed to do it and get their arms around it. So by interviewing national crane houses, as they're called, national organizations similar to the operating engineers and the IBEW and the home builders, by interviewing them and getting their arms around it, they decided that under 17 and a half tons would be one classification for hydraulic cranes. Over 17 and a half tons, and if you can appreciate this, this is a crane that can be operated by one individual all the way up to 300 and 400 and 1,000 ton machine now as a hydraulic machine. In addition to that, they've gone to two other classifications, and that is the crawler lattice boom and a truck lattice boom, which is similar to what we have down here on the street. And do know that ANSI and NCCO have also matured over the past 15 years. Now they incorporate, and if I can ask, Jared, overhead crane, tower crane,
yep.
Rigger,
yep.
And single person.
Yep.
Is that right? So they've also matured in the last 10 years, realizing that if the industry is going to be safe and that they need to be that cornerstone of safety for the industry, NCCO is that group. So I hope that helps.
So the standard that we're setting forth in Senate Bill 97 is consistent with the industry practices that you've just described?
To the best of my knowledge, yes, exactly. What I'm.
In other words, we're not conflicting with.
No.
What? Okay.
That's correct.
Any questions of Mr. Let me ask one more question before I do it. My memory is that there is another crane certification organization, or potentially is there an end? CCO and then some other organization, or am I thinking something?
Crane Institute of America, who has been coming to Alaska for many years, I believe is the only other nationally recognized crane program. There may be others out there, but that's the only other one that I know that has come to Alaska and is to my attention. And what Mr. Headley has done with Crane Institute of America is he's gone back and made sure that he meets the NCCO qualification and has satisfied that, I believe.
Okay, so both organizations that would train crane operators can comply with this. Is that the correct way to frame the question?
Both organizations, NCCO only tests and only offer tests, where Crane Institute of America will train you and test you. So NCCO becomes more like the federal standard. They do no training. They do not endorse any training.
I understand.
So they're totally separate of any other interest in the industry other than casualty prevention or loss prevention.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just one point of clarification. There is, it's Gray Mitchell for the record, there is one other organization that has a nationwide accreditation at this point, and it's, I don't remember the exact name of it, but it's out of Southern California. And right now, you know, this is a growing area, and these entities such as the Crane Institute of America and the National Commission for Certification of Crane Operators, they are providing approvals to local training providers. That's what the Alaska Crane Consultants business is an arm of the Crane Institute of America. So they have approved this local business in Alaska to provide their curriculum. What we expect as this bill, you know, passes would be that there would be other businesses that would develop in order to provide this training. The roadmap is there.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Andrews or Mr. Mitchell while he's here? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, gentlemen. The only question I have is trying to rectify in my mind under the exemptions for electrical line work. That's an exemption for the difference in weight capacity from 5 tons to 17.5. Is that what it is? That's the only exemption then? And everything else above?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas.
Would be covered. Is that correct?
That's correct. This exemption is for electrical line work performed by a licensed electrician with a certificate of fitness as a lineman, up to a crane that's 17.5 tons in capacity. Once the crane goes over that amount, it would require certification.
That's right.
And your point about the 5-ton threshold is also accurate, but that is the standard threshold in the bill.
Correct. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Thomas. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much. And I understand Mr. Kibbe signed up, but as I understand, is not wishing to testify. Just confirming that. But there's a Mr. Rob Peterson.
Thank you, Senator.
Either way.
Left or right?
Hi, good afternoon.
Please.
My name is Rob Peterson. I live at 9043 Lupin Lane here in Juneau, Alaska. I work for the operating engineers as a district rep here in Southeast Alaska, and currently also serve on the Alaska Safety Advisory Council. So I did wish to speak on this bill. I have been a heavy equipment operator and heavy equipment mechanic in the state of Alaska for 28 years, and I support this crane bill for several reasons, but most importantly, the safety of the unsuspecting public, trade workers, and equipment operators that work around cranes in the state of Alaska every day. So some of this, I was not at the last meeting, may have already been gone through, but I'm going to go back through some of it if that's all right. The summary of construction-related crane deaths for the 12-month period in 2008 was 58, and there were 126 injuries. Now, out of that, that's just what was reported. So we have a very big state here that's, with cranes and other things, is fairly unregulated. So again, that's all that was reported in the U.S., but we obviously know there's a lot more. So the causes of construction worker crane-related incidents in that 12-month period in 2008, by percentage, was the main one was crane collapses. Second was overhead power line contacts, people being struck by crane loads, being struck by other crane parts, and 23% other causes. So in summary, in the United States, in that 12-month period, we had a total, again, reported 97 crane incidents involving 57 deaths and 127 injuries. Just to note, the two states with the most incidents, Florida and Texas, and out of the 15 states that now have NCCO or crane licensing certification for operators, those two states do not, and they're the highest. So going back a little bit farther, from 1992 to 2006, there were 632 crane-related deaths. So an average to 2006 of 42 a year, and now, as Gray said, it's gone up to about 70 to 75 a year. So it's growing every day. In that time, there was also 18 multiple death incidents involving a total of 40 deaths. The causes, the main causes. So overhead power line electrocutions, 157 deaths in that time. Struck by crane loads, 132 deaths. Crane collapses, 89 deaths. Struck by crane parts, 78 deaths. Falls, 56 deaths. Struck by falling crane parts, 47 deaths. Caught in between loads, 30 deaths. And other causes, 43 deaths. So the types of cranes involved in these fatalities. The main cranes we use in the state of Alaska in construction are mobile cranes. So in that period of time, 71% of all these crane-related incidents involve mobile cranes. So it's the cranes you see that drive down the highways, they're portable, or a crane that's moved to this construction site with tracks on it. It's any crane that is mobile. So with those mobile cranes, 84% again were with power line incidents. 63% were of crane collapses, and 60% were people being struck by crane boob or gym incidents. It's part of the crane coming down on the public. Granted, in the bigger cities, there's a lot more of that type of accident going on, but for us in this state, it's going to be the mobile cranes tipping over and the power line incidences. So the next one I'll talk about a little bit is the main cause of the worker deaths by frequency. So the number one cause is electrocutions again. So when the cranes are swinging loads and they're working around high voltage power lines and they make contact or even get close, it's usually not the crane operator themselves that is killed. It's people on the ground and around the cranes. The electricity will pass through the machine, find somebody on the ground, and those are the people that usually get killed. So, from 1992 to 2006, there were 157 deaths that were from overhead power line electrocutions. Struck by crane loads, again, was 132, and out of those was people that were flagging, directing, guiding, and 32% of those were workers that were not even involved with the crane. So when you have a big construction site like the new parking garage going on over here, there's obviously a lot of work going on everywhere, and not everybody's watching what the crane is doing. He's doing something else, and when there's an accident, tipping over, falling, whatever, people get hurt and people die. So from 1992 to 2006, the number of crane collapses was 81, and the death rate from that was very high. There were 89 deaths. Part of the reason we're seeing that now is when I was an apprentice, even back in 1982, you could take a crane and you could stand it up on its outriggers, and you could sort of feel if it was going to tip. You know, this is now 2010. Everything's designed lighter. The booms are lighter. If you look at a load chart in a crane, they have very few tipping points on the load charts now. Most of it has to do with structural failure. So if you're picking a heavy load and you go above that rate in the load chart, the crane is going to collapse. Something's going to break. It's going to come down. So the trades workers who died. So in that same period from 1992 to 2006, and this is again reported, and I would assume the death part is pretty accurate, but construction laborers, again unrelated to the cranes, was 191 deaths. Heavy equipment operators was 100 deaths. Supervisors, managers, administration, 86 deaths. Iron workers, 42 deaths. Mechanics, 41. Other trades, 171 deaths in that time frame. So our recommendation in mind from the operating engineers is, and for the general public, is crane operators should be certified. They should be licensed. You need a license to run a forklift. You need a license to drive a car. You need a license to be a private pilot. But in this state, you don't need a license to run a 300-ton crane picking very heavy loads over highways and working around 50 to 60 workers that could be working on a building site. So it's funny to me that we do require licensing for all of these things, but the crane accident rate and the death rate obviously is getting out of hand, and we feel that there should be licenses. We also feel that crane riggers and signal persons should be adequately trained. Crane inspectors should also be certified. I realize we're only talking about operators in this bill, and it's a great start. So conclusion, I thank you for listening. Again, you probably heard some of these numbers at the last hearing, and I appreciate you giving me the time to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Senator Bundy?
Yeah, thank you. You have a lot of data there from states that require certified operators. Do you have a breakdown in the accident rate between certified and non-certified? You know, you mentioned driver's license and pilot's license. There are drivers I wouldn't ride with and pilots I wouldn't fly with. Just because we give them a license doesn't give them any brains. And I don't want to have the illusion that we pass this bill and there are not going to be any more accidents. I assume there will.
There absolutely will. I mean, through the chair, Senator Bundy, there's a lot of things that go into operating a machine, and there's also several people on the ground, engineers that design certain picks involved when you're working in construction. So you cannot eliminate some unseen things that could actually come up. But to answer your question is, the only data I have is the two states where they don't have licensed operators, they have the highest mortality rate and the highest accident rate in the United States, that being Florida and Texas.
Well, Alaska doesn't have them either, so we don't. we don't have the highest, or we're not among the highest, but anyway, I've made my point that, we can't eliminate all
you can't.
Accidents. Even a trained operator can or will have an accident. So, thank you.
Right. Any questions of the committee? Just, I guess, one, if you could comment upon the 17.5-ton, that classification number, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's a good compromise. I think what I've learned in being in Juneau here for the last 3 years, with anything, there has to be some compromise, and I think that's a fair number. When you look at the statistics, that 17.5-ton is really going to be a lot of boom trucks and people delivering to, say, homes with trusses from Spenard Builder Supply or some of the smaller things that go on with the electrical contractors, and it's no less dangerous. There's power lines, there's ways to tip over cranes, unloading trusses. They're all dangerous, but I think it's a fair compromise on the weight. I think it's been proven that most of the accidents are happening with the larger machines.
So. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Senator Meyer.
Okay, so most of the cranes over 17.5 will be commercial, is what you said. Is that correct?
Well, probably most cranes, all cranes are commercial.
Okay, are used for commercial purposes.
Right.
Yeah. Can you go to an equipment rental place and rent a crane?
No, not very easily. There are crane companies in Fairbanks now where you can rent a crane with an operator.
I guess I was thinking, like, in Anchorage, can I go rent a crane and not have a license and operate it?
If the rental company rented them and you could get the insurance from it, you probably could. But not knowing that, in Juneau, the rental company here in Juneau would not rent out a crane, nor do I believe that they even have them for the use of general public, like you would, say, go rent a backhoe for the weekend.
Okay. Thanks.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I think that concludes the people that have signed in. Is there anyone off-site? No one off-site. Is there anyone that would like to testify? I guess seeing none, we'll close public testimony. You know, I indicated that I was intending upon holding it. Is there any comments that anyone on the committee would like to make? Senator Bundy.
With the proviso that there's nothing we can ever, any law we can pass to make the world idiot-proof, I would suggest that you move the bill along. I don't know what more we could learn. If you're ready for a motion.
Any feeling on the committee regarding that, Senator Meyer? I mean, I kind of started off saying I was thinking about holding it, but you
changed
know,
your mind, didn't you?
Yeah. I guess I wasn't thinking on whether or not I would support moving it because you said you weren't thinking about doing that. But I guess I don't really have any major objections either. I'm trying to recall. And reading back through the minutes of the last time we met, that there seemed to be some opposition to this, and but certainly don't hear it today. So either we've met the opposition and everybody's happy, which that hardly ever happens, or there's still some issues out there. But if there are some issues out there, hopefully we will have time to correct it, even if the bill moves. So I don't have any problems, Mr. Chairman.
You know, again, I don't want to. You know, kind of catch somebody off guard. You know, if we're going to move it, I want to really have a strong consensus. And Senator Thomas, do you have any feelings? I mean,
I have no objection to moving it, and would make the motion unless Senator Bundy, who started to make the motion before, almost I think.
but Mr. Chairman, I just regarding Senator Meyer's concern, I think the 17.5-ton has taken some of the concern away about the Spinard Builder boom trucks.
Right. I think so.
Okay.
Senator Thomas?
I would make a motion that we move...
Hold on.
Comment there.
For the record, my name is Paula Scavero. I'm the legislative liaison. There's a technical amendment you need to do on Section 8 of the bill. It says this bill takes effect January 1, 2010.
Yeah. Okay, we can we can incorporate that into the motion as well, or we can do that right now, I suspect.
I just wanted to bring that up because that would be a little problem for us.
Why don't you just make a conceptual amendment, I think?
Yeah. And what is the suggestion as far as the
effective date?
The takes effect January 1, 2011? I would move that we change in the section the effective date to January 1, 2011. Is that how we advance that as part of the?
Mr. Chairman, I've
Did you choose 11?
Well, they needed a year.
Need a year?
That's what I heard the testimony.
Is that what you said? They needed a year.
I'm tempted to object just to point out we could really get things done rapidly if we just backdated everything. No objection.
I would move that we refer Senate Bill 97 version /R, I believe I'm looking at the correct one, is that,
yes.
Is that it? To the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
As amended.
As amended, correct. Thank you.
Any objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 97 has passed through Senate Labor and Commerce. And before we adjourn, I know that I'll just announce our next meeting is this Thursday, January 28th at 2 p.m. And Commissioner Bishop will be here to present an overview on gas line training programs in the state of Alaska. So I think it should be a fairly interesting overview and presentation to us. So with that, Senate Labor and Commerce is closed for the